Welcome to the HR Power Hour, presented by Career Management Associates. I'm David Chulo. It's about all things in the human resource world. We're going to bring in local, regional, and national guests, and we're going to talk about a variety of topics and explain why human resource management is critical to your business success so that you can make decisions to keep and retain great talent.
Welcome to the HR Power Hour, presented by CMAcareer.com and Verrill-Law.com. I'm Tawny Alvarez, your host from Verrill, and today our guest is Kelly Donahue, partner at Verrill in the Intellectual Property Practice Group. And today we're talking about Intellectual Property 101 for Human Resource Managers. Welcome, Kelly.
Thanks, Tawny. Thanks for having me.
Well, first, let's get to know you a little bit. I always think it's important for our listeners to understand why an individual is on the show and what expertise or kind of knowledge base they bring to the show itself. So tell me a little bit about you.
Yeah, sure. So I'm a trademark attorney, and what that really means is that I'm a brand geek at heart. So what really makes me tick is what makes you pick a particular product off a shelf at the grocery store. You know, why that cereal over a different brand of cereal? And so while there are a lot of marketing concepts in that, there are also a lot of legal concepts. So my day-to-day involves helping companies select the trademark that they might use on that box of cereal, whether there's a low or high risk for them in selecting that trademark, and then helping them protect that mark here in the US and then all over the world.
So is the work that you do really only product orientated, or is it also based off of service or other, when we use the term product, is it broader, like product in a service orientation as well? For our listeners who maybe don't create a physical product.
Yeah, sure. So you can have a trademark in a product or a service. So it's really easy to define what a trademark is in that product category because you're actually seeing it on the product or you're referring to that product by that trademark. But it can also apply in the service industry as well. You know, what do you want consumers to say, to refer to or to order or to engage you in those services? So it can apply to a product or a service.
So when you say that the things that we see on shelves or the products or services that we use in our everyday life also involve some legal aspect and not just marketing aspects or reasons why people choose the brand or the service, what do you mean by that? Like where does the law come into effect? I mean, I feel like I can open up a Word document and TM and copyright are part of the symbols. Can't I just throw that on there?
Yeah, so you're actually talking about this whole field of intellectual property, and there are a lot of different types of intellectual property. You know, the four most common types of intellectual property are trademarks, which is where I sort of live for most of my day, but there are also copyrights, patents, and trade secrets. And we can certainly go into more detail about what those types of IP are, and I think that's important to understand in order to talk about it in the employee context.
No, absolutely. So I think a lot of people are probably thinking, well, isn't this an operational topic? Do I really need to know anything about intellectual property laws and all these words that Kelly just kind of spouted off, trademark, copyright? How does it play into the relationship I have with my employees? We're going to get to that, right? But just to make sure I'm clear, intellectual property does directly have or tie into the relationship we have with our employees in order to, I'd say, protect whatever that property is, correct?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, think about all of the content that your employees are creating for you on a daily basis. You know, someone owns that content, whether it's a certain type of creative work, whether it's actually something more technology driven, like an invention or a particular way of doing something or a way to make a process faster. All of those things, you know, your employee can be creating for you within the scope of their employment.
So let's actually get into and discuss what these terms are that you're using and what the differences are between the four terms that you used earlier. So patent, trademark, copyright, and trade secret. I know that as a group, we refer to this all as intellectual property more generally, but what's a patent?
Yeah, sure. So a patent prevents someone else from using, making, or selling a specific invention within the U.S. And there are a couple of different types of patents. One of the more common is a utility patent, and that really protects how something functions, you know, how a solar panel functions and provides power to a home. That would be something that you could protect with a utility patent. There's another type of patent called a design patent, and that really protects how something looks. So how a chair looks aesthetically, or, you know, the particular shape of some type of product. So those are really what we're talking about when you're referring to a patent.
So if we go back to your kind of discussion about cereal, right? Does that mean that somebody has a patent on a cereal box?
There could be some type of design patent on like the overall aesthetics of that cereal box, particularly if they're getting really creative and having a really unique kind of shape to that cereal box. You know, it's curvy instead of the, you know, four corners that you typically see in a cereal box. It's possible there could be a design patent on that. There may be some type of patent in the process of, you know, how that cereal is manufactured or created. So there can be a lot of different IP rights kind of wrapped up in one particular product.
So we've got design patents and utility patents. If we are going to talk about something that we all use on a daily basis, let's say a zipper, where does a zipper fall within? Is it a design? Is it a utility? I think people think oftentimes, oh, I wish I had designed or created X, Y, and Z because I'd be making so much money now, right? It always goes back to how much money they're going to be making. But what, like a zipper, is that, could it be both? Is it one or the other?
Yeah, so technically it might be able to be both. So how that zipper functions, you're really talking about a utility patent. If there's some really unique design to that zipper, you know, the pull on the zipper is really aesthetically pleasing. It's really different from any other zipper you've seen out there. That really signifies, you know, the manufacturer of that particular zipper. There could potentially be a design patent in there as well.
So if there's a patent on something already, does that mean that you can't use it, or does that mean that you have to pay somebody in order to use it? Or let's say I'm making pants and I'm going to sell those pants and I have a zipper on the pants, right? Mm-hmm. Do I have to pay a certain amount of money to whoever owns a zipper patent? Or if I just buy the zipper, is that good enough?
Yeah, I mean, usually in that context, you would just sort of buy the zipper and then like incorporate it into your product. But there are certain situations where you might have to obtain a license from that patent owner in order to use, you know, that patented invention that they own. So it can arise in a lot of different situations.
So you've just used another term that I don't know or understand kind of in this way. So when you say you need to obtain a license, what does that mean? And I'm guessing, and I'm asking now, because I have a feeling that we're going to talk about licenses when we talk about trademarks, copyrights, maybe even trade secrets. So what is a license in this context?
Yeah, so in simplest terms, a license is just an agreement between two parties where, you know, one party has something that the other party wants to use. So a license sort of sets out the legal parameters surrounding, you know, how that party can use something that the other party owns. So let's say I own a trademark and another entity wants to use that trademark for whatever reason, we would enter into a license agreement, which specifically puts parameters around how that other company can use the trademark that I own. What are the circumstances where it can use that trademark? Why can it use that trademark? And kind of sets the parameters for that relationship.
Okay, so we have now talked about patents. What's a trademark? Because you were just talking about trademarks and potentially having a license around it, and you are a trademark attorney, you have said. That is the focus of the work that you do. So tell me about trademarks.
Yeah, sure. So a trademark can be a word, it can be a logo, it can be a design, it can be some type of slogan that really identifies your products and services from the products and services of someone else. So a lot of the really iconic trademarks that you think of are the word Nike, the Nike swoosh, the logo on the Starbucks cup that you might get in the morning. Again, going back to that cereal box, the word Kellogg's that appears on a lot of those cereal boxes. As consumers, we're encountering hundreds of trademarks a day. They're sort of wrapped up into our everyday life. You know, Apple Computers is one of the most iconic trademarks. Those marks signify goodwill. They signify something about the superior quality of those products, or the reason why we pick that product off the shelf versus something else, those trademarks have value. And as consumers, you know, we're interpreting those trademarks and then making decisions based on what we know about that brand, the message that that brand is putting out there into the world, and why we're making that purchasing decision has a lot to do with the trademarks that we see.
I feel like one of the common misconceptions, and at least one that I think I've held in the past, is this idea that trademark does not just involve either images, but it also can involve words. Hmm. So this concept that trademark isn't just either images or isn't just words, but it is images and words, because you could trademark either or both. Could you trademark right. both of them together, I mean?
Yeah, so you have a lot of different options, and kind of the trademark framework gives you a lot of different options. So if you're talking about Nike, which is, it's really easy for everyone to relate to Nike, they know a lot of the different elements of their brand, but the word Nike can be a trademark, and you can file a trademark application for essentially just the word Nike. So it's going to appear in any font, any stylization, any color. You could also file a trademark application for Nike in a stylized form in that particular font and color that you see it most often. Then you can also file a trademark for just a graphic element. So just the Nike swoosh that you see on the side of your sneakers. You can also file a trademark that includes a lot of those different elements. So it could include the word Nike above the Nike swoosh. You can file a trademark application for that. You can also file a trademark application for a slogan, like Just Do It is something that, you know, Nike has trademarked and filed an application for. So you have a lot of different options, and you can certainly discuss with counsel about what makes sense for you. You know, it's not a one size fits all. It's really a what's the protection mechanism that's going to work best for you within your budget, within the scope of the business that you're running.
You're listening to the HR Power Hour radio show. I'm your host, Tani Alvarez, and today we're talking to Kelly Donahue, partner at Verrill in the Intellectual Property Practice Group, and we're talking about Intellectual Property 101 for Human Resources. We've just spent some time talking about what a patent is and now what a trademark is, and during the course of those discussions, we talked about licensing rights to other organizations or entities. We still have two more different types of intellectual property. Copyright and trade secrets. So, Kelly, what you just described as trademark seems so expansive that I'm questioning, what does a copyright protect?
A copyright really gives you the exclusive right to reproduce, publish, or sell an original work of authorship. And that original work has to be kind of fixed in a tangible medium. So it can be a literary work, it can be a musical work, it can be a dramatic or artistic or architectural work. And a copyright can be obtained in something as simple as a book or a photograph or a video or a movie or a song. So it's really some type of creative work that's put down into its final form.
Okay, so I can have a photograph with this image. Could I get a copyright and a trademark on that, or am I only going to get a copyright?
Yeah, usually in that situation, you're really talking about a copyright in that photograph itself.
Okay, so we've got patents, we've got trademarks, we've got copyright,
yep.
And what is a trade secret?
Yeah, so a trade secret really includes information that has economic value to your business because that information isn't generally known by competitors or others in the public. Ownership of this information has kind of a catch to it, though, in that you really need to take a reasonable measure to keep that information confidential and secret. So it's not any business information that you have, but it's that really important business information that you kind of keep under lock and key, and internally you kind of restrict who has access to that information. It's really the core proprietary information of your business. And to kind of give you an example of what a trade secret would be, the sort of most iconic example of that is Coca-Cola's recipe for Coke. That's something that they've kept, you know, really close to their chest. Not a lot of other people know what goes into that soda recipe. And it's a confidential proprietary trade secret of that business.
So we talked earlier about the ability to license like patents or trademarks or even copyrights. Can you license a trade secret, or is that something that I mean, if Coca-Cola wanted to enter into some type of partnership, let's say with Hood Ice Cream or something like that, could they give the recipe to Hood with some type of licensing agreement, or is that potentially breaking whatever the secret is? Because the secret's one of those things that I feel like once you share it, does it really constitute a trade secret anymore?
Right, exactly. And that's that goes to the, you know, they've got to take these reasonable measures to keep that information safe and secret. You know, it can't be something that they're sharing publicly. And if they are sharing it, you know, in that licensing arrangement or between them and another entity, they've really got to put parameters on how they're sharing that information. You know, that other entity has to make sure that they maintain the confidentiality of that information.
We're going to take a quick break. You're listening to the HR Power Hour on News Talk WLOB 100.5 FM and WLOBradio.com. We'll be right back.
At 154 years old, Verrill Dana has an illustrious history and more than seven generations of legal expertise. With more than 130 attorneys across seven offices from Maine to Washington, D.C., Verrill Dana serves clients across the country and around the world. HR professionals, business leaders, and in-house counsel count on Verrill Dana, one of the premier labor and employment law practices in the Northeast. Contact them today at verrilldana.com.
And we're back, and you're listening to the HR Power Hour presented by CMAcareer.com and verrill-law.com. I'm Tawny Alvarez from Verrill, your host, and I'm talking with Kelly Donahue, partner of Verrill in the Intellectual Property Practice Group, and today we're talking about Intellectual Property 101 for Human Resources. So earlier in the episode, we got a kind of a basic primer on the language that we use when we're talking about intellectual property. We talked about the differences between patents and trademarks, copyrights, and trade secrets. Now, does every business have some form of a intellectual property need? You've given some examples, but you've talked a lot about large national companies that we all know, Nike and Kellogg's. But what about if I next week decide to leave the practice of law and just go open up my own storefront? Do I really have any intellectual property needs?
Yeah, I mean, that's such an important question, Tawny, and I think it's really important for everyone to keep in mind that all businesses have IP. Whether you're a large entity, whether you're, you know, a solo person out there consulting, like everyone has intellectual property. To put it in the example of the, you know, Tawny's retail shop that she's going to open, you know, and whatever name that Tawny decides to pick for that Tawny's retail shop, let's say that's the name she picks. Very clever.
So creative. So creative.
That's Tawny's trademark. That's how I, as a consumer, say to my friend, hey, have you been to Tawny's retail shop? Do you know about Tawny's retail shop? That's how Tawny puts that shop in an advertisement or creates a website where people understand, you know, what the shop is, what she's selling, where it's located. So every business has a trademark, and a trademark is separate and different from your legal name. And I think that's really important for everyone to keep in mind. So while Tawny may create an LLC or a corporation for her retail shop, that has a particular entity name that can be separate from the actual trademark that you use.
So what would, like, when we talk about this, I feel like a lot of people are thinking to themselves, well, I don't need an attorney for this, right? Mm-hmm. Like, what, where does an attorney come into this? Like, Tawny opens up a retail shop, she puts a sign on the door, she advertises, she does the right kind of marketing, people come, they know who she is. If I just do that, if I don't get any protection, if in 2 months, Ben decides to open Tawny's retail shop and he opens it, you know, two towns away, do I have any recourse or action when people start going to his Tawny's retail store instead of mine? Or maybe, you know, there's an issue with his customers who are attending Tawny's retail shop owned by Ben versus Tawny's retail shop owned by Tawny?
Yeah, so it's a great question. So as soon as you start to use a trademark, you're developing essentially what's called common law or unregistered trademark rights. So from the minute you put the sign on the front door and opened your retail shop to other customers, you're creating those trademark rights. And it might start as a small bubble that surrounds kind of the town that you operate in. And then as your business gets larger and services more customers located in different towns or cities, that bubble is kind of going to start to grow. So you are developing some trademark rights, which may allow you to reach out to Ben and say, hey, Ben, I've had some customers that have been really confused. You know, my customers are going to your shop and vice versa. And because we're using the same name in such close proximity, that's really confusing. But another way that you can protect yourself is to file a trademark application either on the state level, in, you know, here in Maine or any other state, or on the federal level. And that's something that an attorney can help you with. And the benefit of filing and obtaining a registration and that is that it gives you either a statewide or a nationwide presumption of rights in that trademark. So you can really enforce your trademark a lot better. You'd have some more recourse to take against Ben if you had a formal trademark registration in hand. So that's one thing that I do for my clients on a daily basis. Another thing that I think is really important for you as a trademark owner to do yourself or to engage an attorney is to do an initial search. You know, Ben should have done a search when he launched that business to see if there were any other Tawny's retail shops in the area before he selected that name for his business. If he had done a search, he may have chosen before he even opened his business to refer to it as Ben's retail shop rather than Tawny's.
So we've talked a lot about kind of those general overarching principles. But again, I think as an HR person who focuses my practices only on that, I'm thinking, well, this is still an operational concern. How does this become a human resources or an employment context issue?
Yeah, so I think it's really important to kind of set the culture within your organization of how you're going to approach IP. You know, every employee really creates something of value to the business, you know, no matter what it is, no matter what industry you're in. And I think it's really important for an entity to foster that growth, to have employees that want to try new things or want to approach something from a different perspective and want to do that for the benefit of the organization. And how are we going to capture all the value in those things and really communicate it to our employees and then commercialize that into something that can be more profitable for the business? I think it's also really important to set the tone of, you know, who's going to own that intellectual property early in the relationship. So that's something that you're going to want to see in some of the agreements that you have with your employees or also with independent contractors. And that's something we're going to talk a lot about later. I think another important aspect to the HR, landscape is some of your internal policies. You know, how are you setting the stage with your employees with regard to ownership of IP? How are your employees, you know, using trademarks kind of internally and externally? How are we referring to the brand? You know, are we making sure confidentiality agreements are in place? So there are a lot of ways that IP can impact the employment relationship.
Let's say that I already have a business and I'm listening to this podcast maybe I'm listening to it live. So that I'm listening to this show. And I already have an entity that's been operating for years. We've never had any problems, knock on wood. Is there some type of like default rules? I mean, I've been employing people for decades and I don't have any IP agreements or confidentiality agreements or any other kind of agreements with my employees. Does that mean that they can walk away with all of my information tomorrow? Or what's this? Is there a standard or baseline here?
Yeah, so there are some default rules that are in play. And these rules exist if you have absolutely no written agreement between you and your employees. And what default rule applies depends on the type of intellectual property that we're talking about. So again, we have to go back and refer to patents, copyrights, trademarks, and trade secrets to understand what default rule applies for which type of intellectual property. So for example, if you're looking at a patent, and your employee develops a patent for you, and you have no written agreement between you and that employee, that includes you have no employment agreement or, you know, employee handbook or policy that really deals with this topic.
No documents at all.
No documentation at all.
Lawyer's worst nightmare.
Exactly. The default rule that's going to apply is that the person that invented that particular invention or new type of technology is going to be considered the owner.
So even though I'm paying the individual an hourly wage or a salary, and they've been sitting around for months or weeks thinking on my time as I pay them, if they come up with the idea and I don't have any documents in place, they own it.
Exactly. Yeah, and there are some certain situations where the company might be able to exert some type of ownership right over that patent, but they're very fact specific and a lot of those rights are particularly limited. So that's why in a situation where you are creating an invention or your employee is creating an invention, it's really important to detail the bounds of that relationship in a written agreement and to obtain an assignment of those IP rights ahead of time, not later, but, you know, ahead of time.
So that's our patent. Let's talk about a trademark. So if I have an employee who creates a trademark, what is the kind of default ownership rule in that regard?
Yeah, so trademarks, it actually is a default rule that sort of typically works out in the company's favor. And that's because some of the rules surrounding the fundamentals of what a trademark is are a little bit different. So if your employee does create a trademark or come up with a name for your business or a particular product or service, typically it's going to be the first entity or person that uses that trademark in commerce that's really going to start developing those trademark rights. So in that situation, most of the time, the entity that's going to start using that trademark is really the company or the business that employee works for. So typically in that situation, it's going to be the entity that can assert those ownership rights over that trademark. That gets a little bit different and a little bit more convoluted if, let's say, your employee develops some type of logo design or graphic that you might use as a trademark, but often might be able to be protected by copyright. Copyright is one of those areas where these default rules are also a little bit more messy, and there's a little bit more involved in sort of figuring out what rules apply. And those rules can differ based on whether you're talking about an employee or an independent contractor.
Okay, so we've got the default ownership rules. For those who are just joining us, you're listening to the HR Power Hour, and we're talking to Kelly Donahue, partner at Verrill in the Intellectual Property Practice Group, and we're talking about Intellectual Property 101 for Human Resources. So, Kelly, we now understand what the default rules are. What are some ways in which we can move away from having to follow those default rules without having specific contracts for each of our employees?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so one way we can do that is by developing internal policies and that really discuss the issue of IP. One particular policy, and this is really for kind of, you know, more of a technology driven industry, but is to really have some type of invention disclosure process or kind of a way that you're communicating with your employees about what they're creating from a technology perspective and making sure that we're talking about that, we're disclosing that, we're making records of that. And we sort of have an internal policy that discusses what we do in those situations and how we kind of document that new technology or that new invention that we're developing. You know, you can also have kind of intellectual property language in your employee handbook or your employee guidebook that talks about, you know, what IP is at its core and what happens when an employee creates IP for the company, you know, who owns that intellectual property and kind of how that relationship works.
Now, in my mind, I can hear listeners saying, wait, my attorney always told me that a statement or a policy or a handbook or something like that isn't a contract and it doesn't bind my employees. Mm-hmm. Does having kind of those statements or policies and practices in place, is it different with regards to intellectual property? Does it create more of a right than a contract, or does it have the same weight as a contract would?
So it doesn't have the same weight as a contract would, but it's certainly something that would help you if you had to, or you were in a situation where you had to analyze, you know, who owns what? Is this an employee, an employer, an independent contractor? You know, what's going on in this situation? It's going to be a factor that's ticking in your favor in that analysis if you have some language in your employee handbook or in your guidebook about how you're treating IP, but it's certainly not going to be as good as having a contract in place. So that's why it's so important to, you know, have an employment contract with your employees, or have an agreement, you know, something in writing with an independent contractor that you might engage to perform a particular project or help you with a particular piece of work product.
So we've talked about the types of intellectual property. We've talked about kind of general ownership rules with regards to your employees and policies or practices you could have in place. Let's say that we want to protect our intellectual property as much as possible, and we decide, yes, some type of agreement with each of our employees is the right thing for me. Is that simple enough as just handing them a piece of paper that says everything you create is mine? I mean, is this a one sentence fits all type protection, or what would we be looking at or want to consider when we're drafting an employment contract regarding intellectual property?
Yeah, so unfortunately, it's not always a one-size-fits-all, and it's certainly not just a single page that sort of defines the scope of the relationship. It has to be a little bit more tailored to that. We don't want the employment agreement to be too broad. You know, we don't want it to cover absolutely everything, but we certainly want it to cover the intellectual property that's created by the employee within the scope of their employment, or while they're using the resources provided, you know, by the company.
So are there certain like terms or phrases that we use when creating these provisions? Because I'm guessing you can't just say everything you create until you're fired is mine, because they could be doing it after hours or doing stuff at home. But what about stuff that happens, like they have this thought in the middle of the night and they come in and they test it out and then they create it for us? Do we have to be paying them at the time in which the thought is created? Or, I mean, ideas, inventions, creative works of art, sometimes this doesn't just come into being during either waking hours or time in which we are paying wages to an individual.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So again, it's really important to make sure you have that language of, you know, within the scope of their employment in that situation. While it is something that was kind of maybe thought up, you know, off the job, it was really something that was put into fruition while they were on the job using company resources. But it's important to kind of have that language in your employment agreement where it states and it details just that, you know, that it broadly defines work product to really create, you know, any of the type of intellectual property that you mention. And then also details that if you've created that type of IP within the scope of your employment using company resources, you know, that's either going to be considered a work made for hire, which is a term that we haven't really talked about yet, but it comes up a lot in the sphere of copyrights. And it's sort of an exception to the default rule that we talked about back when we were referring to copyright. So the default rule for copyrights is that, you know, it's the person that created that work that owns it. It's the author's work product. They own that. But an exception to that really falls within the employment relationship within a work made for hire. So if you're an employee developing something for another entity within the scope of your employment, that can be a work made for hire. It can then be owned by the company. But it's really important to kind of have that language in your employment agreement so that it's detailed that work product is a work made for hire. And if it's not, if for some reason there are factors in that relationship that don't kind of fall squarely within that work made for hire sphere and kind of the statutory language that goes along with that, then you're making sure that employee is specifically assigning that work product to the company. And then there's sort of an acknowledgement in the agreement that they're not going to do anything that might be different from, you know, that assignment. They're not going to do anything to harm that IP or assert that IP in some other sphere.
Perfect. Well, we are going to take a quick break. When we return, I'm going to have a bunch more questions regarding employment agreements and the provisions we want to include. But for now, you're listening to HR Power Hour on News Talk WLOB 100.5 FM and WLOBradio.com. We'll be right back.
Are you looking to hire? Stop wasting time. Jobsinme.com has been matching Maine employers to job seekers since 1999. Job postings start at only $159 with their Quick Post product. Your employment ad can be distributed to over 75 job boards for maximum exposure. When it comes to recruiting locally, you can count on Jobsinme to connect you with qualified candidates in this area. Visit jobsinme.com. That's jobsinme.com today. Stop searching and start hiring locally.
And we're back, and you're listening to the HR Power Hour presented by CMAcareer.com and Verrill-Law.com. I'm Tani Alvarez from Verrill, your host, and I'm talking with Kelly Donahue, partner at Verrill in the Intellectual Property Practice Group. Today, we're talking about Intellectual Property 101 for human resource managers. Specifically, so far, we've gone through kind of definitions of all the terms and phrases that we hear so often when talking about intellectual property, things such as copyright and trade secret, patent and trademark. We've then talked about ways in which these concepts or terms affect the operations of your business, and specifically as a human resources manager, things that you should keep in mind when you are considering kind of the creation of some of this intellectual property, understanding both what the kind of baseline is if you don't have any protections in place, and then understanding policies or practices that you could institute. And before the break, we are talking about employment agreements or agreements and contracts that you would sign with individual employees that focus on your intellectual property rights. I mean, in my mind, Kelly, one of the big questions here is when we talk about trade secrets, I've seen employment contracts where the definition of trade secrets is 2 pages long, right? But at the same time, in my mind, a trade secret is something that likely is going to evolve over time and likely over the course of an employee's employment. Is trade secrets a term that has some legal definition, or is an employer required to define it in some way?
Yeah, I mean, there are some sort of like federal statutes that kind of try to put a definition on what trade secrets are. But a lot of trade secret issues are kind of done on a state by state level. And some of those laws can differ from some of the federal language. So I do think it's important for kind of an employer to have a definition of kind of what a trade secret is, what that confidential information is, kind of in that employment agreement.
Now, you just used a term that I think is the first time you've used it during the course of the show, and that's confidential information. Are confidential information and trade secrets something that oftentimes go hand in hand? Are they unique in some way or specifically different?
Yeah, so I kind of think of confidential information as sort of this like broader term that's used. So that can include a lot of different information that might not necessarily be a trade secret. So remember, in order for something to be a trade secret, you kind of have to take that extra step. You're putting a lot of precautions and reasonable measures around how you're protecting that information, kind of how you're keeping it locked up from, you know, others within the organization and obviously externally. I think confidential information can be kind of a broader term that can include a lot of different information. You know, it's still probably proprietary, important to your business, but it might not rise to that level of kind of what a trade secret is.
So if I am in human resources and I have all these agreements that talk about trade secrets and confidential information and protecting them, but then the owner of my business comes in and has a television show that's doing a whole episode regarding her or him, and I watch the show and my owner or manager is showing all of our processes. It's all being video recorded. It's all being kind of aired publicly. Once it's aired in that sense, I mean, have I lost all arguments that it's confidential information, or can I still call whatever I want confidential as long as I believe it's confidential.
Yeah, I mean, you've certainly lost the right to claim that information as a trade secret, so that's definitely out the window. I think once you start talking about something open and publicly like that, you know, you're inch by inch kind of losing the ability to call it, you know, confidential information. So yeah, I think once you start talking about it publicly, you can kind of decrease the nature of that confidential information.
So we've talked a lot at this point in time. I mean, we've talked about how we use it with employees, right? But are there other ways in which we can protect it? Let's say that we want to use independent contractors. Maybe we're in a organization where we're looking to bring in someone different who maybe isn't an employee or is going to provide a service that is different from our core business standpoint. And during the course of that, we need to share confidential information with that individual. I mean, is it safest to just say, figure out how to do it without the confidential information, or have them only do a piece of it? Or are there ways that we can still protect our intellectual property despite bringing in an independent contractor?
Yeah, I mean, I think the basic way to ensure that you're protecting your intellectual property or protecting, you know, the sharing of confidential information is to enter into some type of written agreement with that independent contractor that really details the scope and the parameters of that engagement, and also details what that independent contractor might actually be creating for you. You know, what's the end goal? What's the end work product? Because that can help you understand what types of IP are in play, what type of language you might need to put in that agreement. But I think it's always better to have these conversations upfront, and sometimes presenting an independent contractor with kind of a draft of what that agreement would look like helps to facilitate some of those discussions. You know, another important point that we haven't talked about is pre-existing IP, you know, and that can exist on the employment side or on the independent contractor side. But, you know, what if this independent contractor needs to use some type of work product that they've already created to help do whatever they're doing for us and help complete the project that we're engaging them for? So I think that's also another really important thing to talk about with an independent contractor upfront, and kind of detail in writing between the two of you, you know, how all that's going to shake out.
I think that aspect of it also becomes a really important avenue or area that's discussed a lot when litigation occurs and we are discussing breaches of employment contracts, specifically including language in any independent contract or employment agreement, noting that your company doesn't want, nor is it seeking, any of the confidential or proprietary information of either previous employers or previous entities that the organization, I say organization or individual, has subcontracted with. Mm-hmm. I mean, even if we have that language in there, isn't there an argument that's to be made that once you garner knowledge, you can't just forget it? So isn't there always a chance that even if they don't intend to use that information, you've strengthened their knowledge base in a way that could be adverse to your business?
Yeah, and I think that's also an important concept that we haven't talked about yet, in that intellectual property doesn't necessarily protect more general ideas and concepts. So there may be underlying knowledge that you have just to execute your skills or, you know, perform what makes you a valuable independent contractor or consultant. You might just have this kind of continuing knowledge that allows you to do your job, or allows you to do your job at one company and then on to the next. So intellectual property isn't really going to protect these general ideas, these general concepts, but it is going to protect, you know, if you have an idea for an article, you know, that's not going to be protected. But once you sort of put it down in its written form and you kind of flesh out, you know, what the article is going to be about and the actual text and paragraphs you're going to be talking about, that is something that can be protected by intellectual property. So you're right, there is kind of always going to be this general kind of knowledge floating around, but it's not necessarily something that's always going to be protected by IP.
Now, does this kind of analysis or this review of what's general knowledge, does it become industry specific? Because I feel like there's vast quantities of information that may be extremely technical and industry specific that if I walked in, it would all seem completely foreign to me, and it would all seem like confidential information. It would all seem like a trade secret. But to other people who are working in the industry, maybe only a sliver or a slice of it is truly different than how everyone else in the industry operates. Mm-hmm. Is there a way in which you can contract for those concepts or make sure that you are protecting as much as possible, but not being so broad that someone says, well, you can't protect how to, I don't even know. You can't protect how to cook a steak, mm-hmm. but you can protect X, Y, and Z aspect of cooking a steak. You can tell I'm thinking about food.
I know, exactly. Yeah, I mean, there might not be a way to protect how to cook a steak, but there might be a way to keep confidential and protect the particular way that a certain restaurant does it so that every time you have that steak at that restaurant, it tastes exactly like that. So you're right, you know, and I think there's a way that you can frame the language in the confidentiality section of an employment agreement or an agreement with an independent contractor that really focuses on what you do in your business, what makes your business unique to you, and what's kind of that special sauce, that confidential information that makes your product or service, you know, the way that it is.
We're going to take a break. You're listening to the HR Power Hour on News Talk WLOB 100.5 FM and WLOBradio.com. We'll be right back.
Founded in 1958, Jackson Lewis is a national law firm with a local presence. The firm's 765 attorneys practicing in 54 locations throughout the U.S. and Puerto Rico provide a wide range of resources to address every aspect of the employer-employee relationship. HR professionals, business and in-house counsels, and C-suite professionals count on Jackson Lewis as it has one of the most active employee litigation practices in the United States. Contact them today at jacksonlewis.com. That's jacksonlewis.com.
And we're back, and you're listening to the HR Power Hour presented by CMAcareer.com and Verrill-Law.com. I'm Tani Alvarez from Verrill, your host, and I'm talking to Kelly Donahue, partner at Verrill in the Intellectual Property Practice Group. And we've spent today's episode talking about intellectual property and kind of the basics that human resources directors should have regarding understanding their company's intellectual property and ways in which they can help to protect the organization's either already created intellectual property or soon to be created intellectual property. We went through the basics of what each of the terms were, which I found super helpful because I feel as though I've gone decades talking about things that are probably trademarks, but really are copyrights. And earlier in the segment, I mentioned this kind of idea or concept that why do I need to have any legal protection when Word literally allows me to go up to the symbols and just put that symbol on things? I mean, by doing that, do I have protection, or is this one of those things that it's one and done? Like, I see an attorney, I get a trademark, I never have to talk to that attorney again. Is this a forever thing? I guess in my mind, I want to understand if I go down this trademark or this copyright route, is it just once, or do I have to keep in touch with this attorney all the time?
Yeah, so that's a great question. I first want to deal with the comment that you made about kind of those symbols that you see in Word that that define, you know, a TM, an SM, there's a C in a circle, all of those things.
What's an SM? Because yeah. I don't know if I've seen that one. And it's just like me to ask these compound questions. So yeah, let's talk about Word documents and the symbols, and then I want to jump to like time frame. Sure. So what's SM, I guess?
Yeah, so if you've seen in Word in the symbol section, you've seen the little TM that can kind of be in superscript next to a word. You use that symbol often to say, I either have an application that's pending, or I don't have an application that's pending, but this is a word that I'm viewing as proprietary. And typically you'll see that indicated as a TM. You can use an SM if you're talking about a trademark that you're using in connection with a service mark. The SM stands for service mark. So again, that TM or SM is indicating that you filed an application and it's pending. You don't have a registration yet, or you haven't filed anything, but that's really a trademark that you see as proprietary to your business. Then if you have taken that extra step to file an application and you do obtain a registration, then you can use that R in a circle symbol that you've also probably seen
in
Word. And then that brings us to kind of the second portion of your question, which is this a one and done type of thing? Do I ever have to talk to my attorney again after I sort of do this? And I think it's really important to understand that trademarking is a process, and it's something that grows with your business. So your trademark needs as you first start out as a business may be different than where you're going to be in 5 or 10 years. So I think it's important to have that conversation with your attorney up front, decide what you're initially going to protect. You know, that may just be filing one trademark application, filing that application. It's also a process. You know, it takes a long time. It can be between 8 and 12 months for you to file that application and know whether you're going to be entitled to a registration. And then once you do have a registration, you're kind of not done. You know, you have to renew your trademark at the between the 5th and 6th year and at the 10th year. So you're constantly talking to your attorney about renewing that trademark and then sort of reassessing, do I have the proper protection that's in line with the growth of my business?
So we talked earlier about kind of evolution of some trademarks too, about like Nike, the swoosh sign, Just Do It. If you change the font or if your marketing evolves, is that something that you need to protect again, or do you have a broad enough protection that you don't need to do something like that?
Yeah, so if your marketing changes or evolves, I think that's a trigger for you to go back to your attorney and ask whether you have the proper protection for kind of the new wave of your branding. In some instances, you can have the proper protection if you initially filed the trademark application as a word mark or a standard character mark, which means you're just protecting that word no matter what kind of graphic or font or stylized presentation it's in. If you initially filed your trademark application a little bit more narrowly to specifically cover a particular graphic representation or a particular stylized version of that word, you might not have the proper protection that you need. So I think that's why it's important to have a discussion with your attorney. Let them know when something changes. Let them know when your marketing or your branding goes in a different direction, to just reassess and make sure you have that proper protection.
And even more important, I think this is one of those moments where operations and HR need to be in touch with each other, because HR needs to be aware or sure that whatever protections they have in place in their employment agreements as well are sufficient to kind of cover whatever these changes are that are occurring.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, your HR folks might also be helping to maintain like a trademark use policy or some language in some of those agreements that tells your employees how, you know, what trademarks we have and how we're using them. So we all kind of need to be in sync about what's going on.
Kelly, thank you so much for your time today. I really appreciate it.
Thanks, Tani. It's been a pleasure.
You've been listening to the HR Power Hour on News Talk WLOB 100.5 FM and WLOBradio.com. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next week. Stay tuned for the HR Tip of the Week.
And now, your HR Tip of the Week. Your HR Tip of the Week is being sponsored by Verrill.
No, pregnancy is not a disability, but you should treat it like it is. Hi, this is Ben Ford from Verrill's Labor and Employment Practice Group. For years, the law around pregnancy accommodations has been a bit confusing, with some courts holding that they are disabilities under the ADA and other courts holding that they are not. Well, state legislators have begun to step in to clarify the law and saying that pregnancies are not disabilities, but you still need to accommodate complications from pregnancies as if they are. This means that a pregnant worker would be entitled to such things as a stool or a slightly longer break during pregnancy. After their pregnancy, they would also be entitled to lactation facilities, which are usually small rooms that can be locked and secured and are not bathrooms. There are still many questions remaining about pregnancy accommodation, like, does a pregnant mother need to ask for an accommodation before the employer provides one? Or is it an interactive process the same as the ADA? The good news is that most people are already complying with the law, so it should not present too much of a management burden. But if it does, maybe you should call Verrill's Labor and Employment Practice Group.
And that's your HR Tip of the Week, sponsored by Verrill. Thank you, everyone, for listening, and catch us every week at 10 a.m. on News Talk WLOB 100.5 FM or 1310 a.m. and streaming live at WLOBradio.com. Podcasts of this show and every show are available at hrpowerhour.com. Have a great week, everyone, and remember, HR management is critical to your business's success.